for the appellant in this matter, Shakayla St. Mary. This is an appeal from the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order in the consolidated cases or linked cases of D09-411-937, D09-413-217, filed on March 28, 2011, in the 8th Judicial District, Clark County, State of Nevada. Shakayla asserts that under the facts of this case, as well as the current applicable Nevada law, that she is the legal parent of the subject minor child. Furthermore, the trial should have ruled that she is a parent, and the co-parenting agreement should have been enforced. There are a few undisputed facts, very few undisputed facts in this case, that I'd like to bring up with this honorable court. First and foremost, this is a same-sex relationship wherein the parties had an intimate sexual relationship. Number two, they cohabitated from the time of conception through the birth for at least 8 months. Third, the birth certificate listed Shakayla as the birth mother. Thereafter, Veronica, the respondent in this case, was added to the birth certificate. Furthermore, the birth certificate, both the original one and the second one, hyphenated both Shakayla and Veronica's last name for the last name of the subject minor child. The applicable law for this, Your Honors, which the trial court did not apply, is the Uniform Parenting Act. Specifically under NRS 126-231, who may bring an action? Any interested party may bring an action to determine the existence of a mother and child relationship. Well, in this case, there were two actions. The first one was simply adding Veronica's name to the birth certificate. Now, just to give the court a little more background on this, another undisputed fact is...
Counsel, before you get too far into the facts, what's our standard of review as to this issue? And very specifically, what did the court do wrong within the Parentage Act?
The standard of review and what did the court do wrong? Your Honor, and I apologize, I can't answer the standard of review on that. I apologize to the court. It was brief for the court, but we're in essence putting a square peg in a round hole.
Well, Counsel, you're bringing this action and you want us to overturn the lower court.
So yes, Your Honor.
It kind of starts with what our standard of review is.
And, Your Honor, I can do nothing else other than clear and convincing evidence. I would have to assert that that's going to have to be the standard of review. And the only reason I can say that is under the Uniform Parenting Act, they articulated clear and convincing evidence several places in the statute, Your Honor. Now, why does Shakayla want this court to overturn the trial court's decision? Well, first and foremost, there was a co-parenting agreement. That co-parenting agreement, it's undisputed, was executed by the parties prior to the birth. The court found that that was null and void. The court also found and applied the parole evidence rule as a clear and unambiguous document.
Well, I'm going to back you up. Why wasn't that, in fact, the district court found that parenting agreement to be null and void?
The district court gave no reason for that, Your Honor.
I thought the district court actually indicated that, or there was an argument that it wasn't a proper agreement because it dealt with a surrogacy issue.
That was the arguments made by both sides on this appeal. The district court level made no articulation of specifically why it was found null and void, Your Honor. But looking at what this court is questioning, the current surrogacy statute. Now, the current surrogacy statute is NRS 126-045. That states that two persons whose marriage is valid under NRS Chapter 122 of NRS may enter into a contract with a surrogate. Your Honors, that's not what we have here today. What we have here today is a co-parenting agreement between two same-sex partners.
Why can't we decide this issue, this whole case, on contract principles like they did when Lee Marvin first came alive in the state of Nevada, where the unmarried folks claimed a part of the estate, the marital estate, even though they weren't married? Why can't we just decide this case on contract principles?
And I absolutely agree with Your Honor, Chief Justice Cherry. This should have been decided on contract principles. In Rivero v. Rivero, and court's indulgence, just one second. In Rivero v. Rivero, this court stated that a contract will be enforced if not unconscionable, illegal, or in violation of public policy. Well, we have a co-parenting agreement executed between two same-sex, a couple in a same-sex relationship. That co-parenting agreement is not invalid, illegal, or unconscionable.
Unless it's viewed as a surrogacy agreement.
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence that it was put into evidence at the time of trial that it was to be viewed as a surrogacy agreement. Again, the parole evidence rule was put in. The court found that it was the document itself, the four corners, were clear and unambiguous. So as we look at Rivero, is it illegal, unconscionable, or in violation of Nevada law? Well, we know the state of Nevada after that has adopted the Domestic Partnership Act. That did not come effective until October 1st, 2009. The agreement that we're is at issue today was executed by the parties on October 5th, 2007, prior to the enactment of the Domestic Partnership Act. However, I'd like to bring the court's attention to NRS 122A300, where it does state that the parties can enter into a contract upon termination of a domestic partnership for custody of children. Now, before that time period, before the enactment of that in 2009, was it illegal? Was it unconscionable? Was it a violation of public policy? There is no Nevada law on point. There is no Nevada case law. And there, I would assert there is no reason to find that in violation of public policy, certainly not illegal.
Counsel, let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does best interest of the child affect your case at any level?
Currently, under the Uniform Parenting Act, that's not one of the factors, Your Honor. Under the Uniform Parenting Act, and this is from the articulation in Russo v. Gardner, which is 114 Nevada 283 from 1998. That case, the Russo case, stated that the court is to apply the provisions of NRS 126.051. And under that, 126.051, a man, and again, we're putting a square, for lack of a better way to put it, Your Honors, we're putting a square peg in a round hole, but it states that a man is presumed to be the natural father of a child if, and it gives the factors, A, B, C, C1 and 2, as well as D. None are applicable to this case. However, I would like to point this court's honorable attention to subsection 3 of that. Subsection 3. If two or more presumptions arise with conflict with each other, the presumptions of which facts is founded on the weightier considerations of public policy and logic controls. Let's talk about logic for 1 second here.
Before you do, counsel, you're not suggesting that parties can contract with respect to parental relationships without regard to the Uniform Parenting Act, are you?
No, Your Honor. As far as can a party's contract on whose mother and whose father, that is not authorized by Nevada law. The Uniform Parenting Act simply gives this court and the lower courts a guideline to figure out who's the mother and who's the father.
So you would agree that the contract in this case has to be construed after taking into consideration the provisions of the Uniform Parenting Act, depending upon how this court interprets that act.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. And under the
Can I ask a follow-up question to
Your
Honor. And it also follows up Justice Sada's question a bit. If you're going to concede that Chapter 126 is the best analog and that this contract should be analyzed under it, you give that concession, correct?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor.
And what do you do with 126.101, which says the child must be made a party to the action and the child gets a guardian ad litem to consider the child's interests?
Understand, Your Honor, the pretrial procedures here were not applied by the district court level.
But the question remains, apropos to Justice Sada's question, which is where do you focus on the best interests of the child. And it seems to me this statutory scheme says, look, parties who are debating parentage and paternity and maternity are very impassioned about their relative positions. But the child has a stake in the game as well. And for that reason, I submit the statute says the child should be made a party to the action. And I don't see that here. Whatever informality may have occurred in the district court, however excusable, it's a concern to me that I would like addressed of why this child was not made a party to the action, why a guardian ad litem was not appointed. I can read this statute and say, yeah, it's talking about mother and father and suits to establish paternity, et cetera, and in that context the child must be made a party, but you're piggybacking on that statute. And it's of concern to me in this case.
I understand the question, Your Honor. However, respectfully, my review of the Uniform Parenting Act indicates that first paternity or maternity is established. Following that, the best interest of the children, or child in this case, is taken into consideration for custody issues. Nowhere in, and I've read every statute, nowhere in the Uniform Parenting Act could I find best interest.
Right, but you do have 126.1011, which says the child must be made a party to the action. If the child is a minor, the child must be represented by his or her general guardian or guardian ad litem appointed by the court. The child's mother or father may not represent the child as guardian or otherwise. I mean, what do you make of that statute?
I understand, and there is actually three cases in Nevada that have referenced the Uniform Parenting Act, and I apologize, I don't have the specific site on what I'm going to reference.
Don't worry about it.
They looked at that, and then for later on, for modification of the amount of child support, they looked at the child having the guardian ad litem, but in nowhere of the three cases, limited case law, that ever referenced that, did I see anything regarding a guardian ad litem arguing for who should be mother or who should be father beyond the limited circumstance that if we had someone inappropriate. There is one where the which I think the court referred to as the non-biological father was guilty of domestic violence against both the child and the biological mother. And there the guardian ad litem, not questioning parenting, could step in and say, hold on, you should not have custody. I would like to point this.
Wouldn't that be more relevant in a situation where you're going to essentially be terminating one parent's parental rights? There may be a contest between a biological father and a putative father, and one of them is going to end up with a right terminated, in which the child's interest at that point would be more compelling, I would think.
Justice Perry-Gary, I did not think about that, and I would absolutely agree with that under that circumstance. And I apologize for not coming up that on my own, Your Honor.
And more importantly, you're asking us by your own words to put a square peg into a round hole. This certainly would be the time for us to consider whether or not in determining parentage, the best interest of the child should be considered. Would you not agree with me? You're essentially asking us to declare that there are, under our law, with some help from this court, we can declare that there can be two legal parents, both of whom are mothers.
Yes, Your Honor. And am I asking this court to apply the best interest standard? I'm asking this court to apply the existing law, and I'm not directly answering your question, Your Honor, and I apologize, but again, there's no guidance for us on this.
But following up on Justice Perry-Gary's question, this child has interests that are implicated by the determination if she has one or two mothers, because if she only has one, then effectively the other mother has been denied the putative maternal rights. If she has two, that too is something that's going to affect the child's life. So why shouldn't that child be made a party and have its in her, his or her interests considered?
Regarding, and again, I understand the question, Your Honor, regarding the best interest of the child, the guardian ad litem asserting in court at the district court level who should be mother and who should be father. Unless there is an extreme situation, such as the Honorable Justice Perry-Gary mentioned, or I should say the unusual circumstance, where we do not have a fit and proper parent, where we have domestic violence, drug use, none of which was present in this case, the trial court found Shekayla to be a fit and proper person to have third-party visitation. There is one very important statute, because I'm running out of time, I want to bring this court's attention to. Under the standards set forth in 126.041, it states, the natural mother may be established by proof of her giving birth to the child. Well, in this case, it's undisputed that Shekayla gave birth. I would assert to this court, under these circumstances, the facts of this case, at the trial court level, it is not Shekayla's burden to assert that she is mother. The statute says she is mother.
Aren't there actually two competing presumptions there, as far as the biological aspect and the birthing aspect?
We have the donation of the egg by Veronica with nothing in writing, though, and that's the problem. NRS 125.045 appears to prohibit that, because it says two people whose marriage is valid or NRS 122 may enter into a contract for surrogacy. On that statute, Your Honor, I would like to note for this court that my NREP 44 notice to the clerk was filed late, but this court does have the authority to consider sua sponte the constitutionality of NRS 126.045 as it relates to single people or heterosexual couples or same-sex couples. I'm out of time.
Counsel, before you sit down, you cited a statute and you talked about the word may. May is normally a discretionary phase. It's not a mandatory phase. And you're using it in a mandatory form. Why should we look at it that way?
Your Honor, because the trial court, I'm assuming, and I believe most other attorneys that I've spoke with this on assume, when a statute says...
Do you have some authority other than attorneys you spoke with?
Other than their certified family law specialists.
That doesn't cut it, counsel.
Your Honor, my response would be this. Two people whose marriage is valid under NRS 122 may enter into a contract. Is that prohibitive? It's voluntary for them. It's discretionary.
Well, from your standpoint, because you're trying to use it as a sword at this point, that's why I'm asking you, is it not discretionary opposed to mandatory?
It's discretionary for the people to enter into it, but I would say that it's prohibitive and mandatory that if you are not married, you cannot enter the contract for surrogacy.
We're not talking about the contract. We're talking about the phrase you just used, that the court may, from your standpoint, must accept the birth mother, so to speak. That seems to be what you're arguing.
And, Your Honor, and I put apples and oranges together. But my point is that the statute, Uniform Parenting Act, does say that Shekayla is mother. But the 126.045 says you may enter into a contract for surrogacy if you're legally married in the state. That would logically infer that it's prohibitive against anyone who is not legally married, which, by the way, I would like to note, they can still have a surrogate. They can still do the act. There's no prohibitions in Nevada against a single or a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple getting a surrogate, having a child. There's just a restriction on the contracting of it.
The contracting is usually between the parents and the surrogate as opposed to parents.
That is correct, Your Honor. And respectfully, Honorable Justice Perigur, I would state always is between the parties who are donating or the intended parents, which the Nevada legislature has used that language, and the surrogate. Not with parties in a same-sex or a heterosexual relationship.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, and Mr. Trigger, I'm going to give you 17 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, good morning. My name is Bradley Schrager. I am counsel for Respondent Veronica Damon, appointed by this Court as appellate counsel. Your Honors, I would first like to speak to Justice Pickering and Justice Sada's concern regarding the best interest of the child, and then move on, tracking back to Justice Douglas, your concern regarding the applicable standards. Best interest of the child isn't just something pops up in statute. It is the ether in which jurisprudence regarding family law exists. If do no harm is the physician's oath, best interest of the child is the first commandment in family court.
Wouldn't it be in the child's best interest, you know, just taking your argument a step further, and isn't it a policy consideration that the child have two parents in the event that something happens to one of them and doesn't become a ward of the state?
I can see that policy concern, but that would have to be established through proper statutory means. And if, in fact, this court feels that that's true, or the legislature of the state feels that's true, it's their duty to put those procedures into place. But I do want to point something out about the district court's order. I find it to be incredibly humane and cognizant of the best interest of the child. This wasn't simply an order that said, you're the mother, you're not. At length, after great testimony, evidence, all of that, there was considerable care taken by the district court in this order to deal with the child's best interest and to recognize the bonds of affection, the place of appellant in the minor child's life. There was also what I consider to be very sensitive admonishment about how the relationship should proceed.
Why shouldn't the child be made a party under the statute, though? I understand everybody's solicitous of the best interest of the child, and I credit your point that that's the animating first commandment or first rule. But the statute expresses a clear preference that somebody who's level-headed speaks for the child and advocates for the child, not just that the courts take care of it, but that the child has a role in the proceeding. Why shouldn't this child have been made a party to this case and had a guardian and a lawyer?
You know, I think that's probably true. I myself serve as a CAPS attorney down south. I understand and I respect, and I live by those procedures myself. My client didn't bring the case. I can't answer for that particular procedural aspect of it. The only mention of it in the court's order is that the minor child is simply too young to testify.
Absolutely.
But a voice could and should have been, perhaps, offered on behalf of the child. That didn't happen.
Well,
I don't think
well,
you are
perhaps,
that
perhaps the statute could be read, though, to say that the joinder of the minor child becomes necessary and relevant once the court has determined the parentage question. If the court determines in a contest over parentage that there is no parent relationship, there's no need to join the child and add guardians on the custody question, which is what the statute refers to. So what is your argument about this parentage question?
Certainly,
Mr.
And that was actually going to be my next point, is that I don't think we are there yet, right? That the statute contemplates first that there be this parentage determination prior to the kicking in of a guardian ad litem.
So why can't there be two moms?
There can be.
Two parents.
There can be.
Why isn't that the case here?
In fact, if you look at the surrogacy agreement statute, it says that two validly married people, which we know in Nevada must be of differing sex, may enter into a surrogacy agreement with the surrogate that would treat parentage issues. Under that type of valid agreement, obviously one of the validly married people will in fact be of the same sex of the surrogate. Under those circumstances, you could in fact have...
But the surrogate falls away. I'm not talking about that situation. I'm talking about the present facts before us, and that is why can't the determination of parentage be made under the UPA as it presently exists, and that the determination is quite simply two moms equal parents in this case?
I think that may be true in the abstract. It is not true under the facts of this case. Look, this is a complicated issue, and I think that the district court dealt with it very well. I think that the period for 4 years now that the relationship with the child has been managed as best as possible under very difficult circumstances, I think that this may be an example where law does not always move at the speed of culture and cultural change. But while this seems like a complicated case, in fact, on legal grounds, it is narrow and simple. Because after more than 2 years of motion practice, hearings, evidence, substantial testimony, the district court made very particular findings of fact and conclusions of law. And this is what goes to your concern, Justice Douglas, regarding the standards. The findings of fact in a case like this may not be disturbed or should not be disturbed by this court absent substantial evidence. the conclusions of law, we review de novo. That's the standard. We have that order. We have those findings. And especially in a family court setting, we should be trusting the district court who is there to make credibility determinations, to determine the best interests of the child. That's the standard of what we're looking at here today. So let's look at some of the particular findings, and that should lead us, I think, in the proper direction of resolution of this appeal. Number one, the court very clearly found that this was a surrogacy arrangement. We can talk about the agreement, but this was a surrogacy, a gestational surrogacy. And that is, in fact, consistent from the start of this case all the way through the evidentiary hearing in December of 2011. At no point
the court rejects that application of the statute, we have to begin anew.
If the court rejects, well, there's a difference between what is
the surrogacy. If this court says that the surrogacy statute doesn't apply to this situation, you have to begin anew.
You would. However, there is a difference between is this a gestational surrogacy, and then what is the meaning of this purported surrogacy agreement?
Counsel, on the surrogate, since you've kind of walked around, isn't there a question when you're dealing with a surrogate, the intent of the parties, the intent of one party only to bear the child and to then walk away, opposed to the intent of remaining with the child?
I think that's a fair point, that intent does matter. And if you want to get to the surrogacy agreement and the intent behind that, counsel stated that the parallel evidence rule was in place at the district court. That's not entirely true. If you read the transcript, in fact, it was very loosely applied. It was applied in name only. And there was evidence and testimony provided having to do with the intent of the parties in entering into that contract. And what's incredibly telling is that this surrogacy agreement was held up and said, what is this thing? What's the provenance? Why does this exist? Neither party, not appellant, not respondent, said this was meant to show our intentions regarding the care and parentage of this child from now until the end of our lives.
Okay, was that part of the visitation considerations or part of the maternity determination by the court? I mean, the court entered a very curt, very terse order on May 19th that essentially said it's determined Veronica Lynn Damon is the biologically the legal mother of the child. That's it.
What
prompted that?
Well,
my understanding was perhaps it was a stipulation between the two of them.
A week prior to that, or a little more than a week, and it's the record at page 7, there was a statement, a sworn statement, notarized statement, by appellant saying specifically, this is the procedure that I underwent. Respondent's eggs were fertilized with an anonymous sperm donor, and the embryos belonging to Veronica Lynn Damon were implanted in my uterus. I am not the biological mother of this child. The biological mother of this child is Veronica Lynn Damon. That's part of the
substantial. What prompted that?
I don't know the answer to that. I assume, it appears
no
to have
been
part
about
of the,
what
part
perhaps
of the
prompted that affidavit.
That appears to have been part of the birth certificate issue,
right.
Which, in my briefing, I think I've made reasonably clear the birth certificate is a reflection. It does not itself.
But the modification of that birth certificate came after in an attempt to co-parent this child. Would you agree with that?
I would not agree with that.
Okay, so the change in the birth certificate.
It came after.
It certainly came after.
Whether the intent was to co-parent, I don't think that's true. In fact, all the testimony, at least for my client, is that was not the intent. Not the intent in entering into the agreement, not the intent in changing their birth certificate, none of those things. And if I can go back to the testimony regarding the purported surrogacy agreement, I've already said no one said this is what we always intended. This is what we meant. Both of them, under oath, both of them said this document was created for two reasons: to satisfy the fertility clinic and to overturn an adverse insurance determination. With ample opportunity, no one said these words are meant to stand to reflect parentage and care and the responsibilities and liabilities going forward regarding this child. And in fact, this can be no other than a purported surrogacy agreement that I think is rather clearly invalidated by 126.045. It treats the very aspects of parenting, parentage, liabilities, care, all those things that Nevada law, very plainly, doesn't allow. Whether that's wise, whether that's unwise, whether that's a policy the legislature wants going forward, I can't say.
So this decision by the district court can be affirmed, in your opinion, by virtue of authority set forth in 126.045 as well as the UPA?
There are several steps. Those are part of it. There are several steps. The district court's order makes perfect logical sense given the flow of this case.
Which order?
I'm sorry, the December or the May order stemming from the December 10th evidentiary hearing. The sort of basic order that is...
The simple curt order.
No, Your Honor. This is a 9-page order setting out all the...
That one, at least the way I read it, pertained primarily to visitation, unless I've got another order.
Now, there's a major problem with that order. Everything refers to...
Yes.
125. Nothing in that even touches in RS 126 a parentage.
Well, I think there's a reason for that, Your Honor.
I'm sure there's a reason for it, but our concern is we're looking at 126, which is legislature enacted, and that we should give it some review in terms of what was before the court, or the fact that the court did not seem to use it in making its decision.
Well, the order certainly does reflect that it took evidence, that it entered orders previously, and that the hearing in December of 2010, culminating in the order of May of 2011, was to be restricted to the visitation issue for the very fact that the court had already determined.
In a very short order, the legal parentage of this child. So it's the original order that Justice Perry referenced that really establishes parentage in this case, correct?
Based upon an affidavit submitted by the appellant we're not quite sure what the purpose is.
I would say that admittedly curt order reflects the law. It itself may be the order that establishes parentage. What establishes parentage is the biological natural connection. There was
what was the nature of the discussion? I got to go back to this order because you keep saying it reflects the law. I'm interested in finding out what that judge was considering when he entered this order. What was the discussion like? What was the hearing like surrounding that particular order? Not going into the visitation, but based upon the affidavit that was presented by the appellant in this case. That's my understanding of what prompted this order. Not a great big hearing and a full discussion of what the law may be.
I can't answer your question. Having entered this case as appellate counsel,
sure.
I understand that. And I don't know that there is a transcript that can answer those questions.
But your position is you're championing that there has been a legal determination that your client is the sole legal and natural mother of this child.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely.
So you're saying parentage or maternity was established under Chapter 126 at some point in this case because you wouldn't have gotten to the other issues if that hadn't occurred, right?
Yes. Yes, I am saying that. Now.
And so you're relying on the short order that simply declares your client the mother of this child?
I am relying on the facts that had to and must have informed that order, Your Honor. I mean, for example, there is no dispute that my client is the biological mother of this child. There is no dispute that she is the natural mother of this child. There is no dispute that this couple is not married. There's no dispute that this couple did not enter into a domestic parenting agreement. There must be a showing of some way for appellant to accede to parental rights under law.
There's no dispute that the appellant was a birth mother either, was it?
That is not a distinction made in Nevada law for establishing parentage.
Not so sure. Now, there's no presumption in Nevada law for a birth mother. And it goes back to the question I asked earlier. You have competing presumptions here.
But if that were taken,
different statutory provisions.
But Your Honor, if that were taken to its sort of broadest interpretation, all adoptions, all surrogacies, all of those would be thrown into question by that presumption. Those have legal avenues by which parenting and parentage are established.
You can't for a moment suggest that an adoption where there is a legal termination is the same as the situation that we have here.
No, that is absolutely not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is that the mere fact of having given birth does not determine parentage.
No, because no, but it raises a presumption. Just as being a biological parent raises a presumption.
I would argue that the presumption of being a biological parent is exceptionally clear in Nevada law, and the other presumption is not commensurate.
Counsel, NRS 126.041 sub 1 states the natural mother may be established by proof of her having given birth to the child under this chapter. So if I read that as I've just read it, giving birth, does it not create some kind of presumption, even rebuttable, as to the birth mother, opposed to what we concede as the natural mother?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. And in fact, it does not, because, as you stated earlier, not only is that may permissive, that may would only function under appropriate circumstances. These are not those circumstances.
And where is that written in the statute?
That it's presumptive?
It's presumptive that it only applies under certain circumstances. How are you making that distinction?
Well, I mean, any statute must be applied to particular facts. The may, which is permissive, must be by this court or any court applied in appropriate circumstances. So it's sort of built into why
it's not appropriate for us to use that in the situation where it is alleged, and I don't believe disputed, that the petitioner in this case gave birth to the baby?
May I continue?
Go ahead, sure.
It is certainly appropriate for you to give that statute consideration, just as you would give all these statutes consideration. I do not believe under the particular facts of this case, the circumstances of this case, that it is in any way determinative, and if in fact permissive, not appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Rager. Mr. Noll, you have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I don't want to lose sight of what I'm here for, and that's Shekayla. The sufficiency of the evidence at the trial court level. Prior to taking any evidence, any testimony whatsoever, the court found that the law of the case was Shekayla only has third-party visitation rights. That was an error as a matter of law. No evidence had been taken up to that point. All of these courts' concerns were not addressed by the trial court level. We assert that under the statute just cited, 126.041, that she is presumed to be the mother and that the burden rests upon Veronica to show that she is also a parent. Justice Perigary, your questions regarding the original order, they were in case 411, I'm shortening it up. Though that was done, to my understanding, I was not attorney of record, but I've reviewed this record with a fine-tooth comb, that was done without a hearing. There was a petition to establish paternity. There was an affidavit from Shekayla that stated, I am not the biological mother. Veronica is the biological mother. Now, the order added the word legal in there. That's what it stated. The reason, as was briefed to the trial court level, the reason asserted on the record in the 413 case was because visitation was being restricted from Shekayla by Veronica, and so she entered that affidavit. But I think the most important point on that, Your Honors, is that Veronica's name was added to the birth certificate. If you have a surrogate, first of all, you don't have an intimate relationship with them. You don't hyphenate the last name to put both of your names on there. You don't have a co-parenting agreement, and you don't add the biological mother's name to it. The term non-biological may sound strange to us, but if we looked at the co-parenting agreement, Shekayla has always been referred to as the non-biological parent. Nevada case law recognizes the term non-biological parent.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Chief,
yes, you have a question.
I don't have a question for Mr. Noll, but I did want to take this opportunity to, if I may, highlight what the Access to Justice Commission has been promoting, and we recognized about a week ago, and that was Pro Bono Week. And I would like to note that both counsel, in my view, did an excellent job with their arguments. Mr. Schrager was appointed as pro bono counsel in this case, and I wanted to bring to the attention of the public and to thank him for his service, along with the many, many other lawyers in the state who accept pro bono appointments to serve and represent clients
without means. Thank you for this indulgence.
Well, thank you, Justice Hardesty, for those facts. And the court joins in Justice Hardesty's statements. The court does thank both lawyers for this challenging case that you presented to us today. Your arguments were superb, the briefs are excellent, and this matter will stand submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And while we're waiting for the next case, I'd like to the court to acknowledge and welcome Justice Seda's law clerks, Owen Mooney's mother is in the courtroom today. And would you just stand up so we can see you? And we certainly welcome you, and we're so thrilled that your son is serving Justice Seda as a law clerk. He's a very intelligent young man, and we're thrilled to have him. You did a good job, Mom.